surveillance to slow the spread of the coronavirus. In Greece, if you go outside, you need to let the government know.
If I want to go to the pharmacy, I have to send a text with the number 1 and my full name and address.
Global transportation has slowed down during the pandemic, and pollution that drives climate change has dropped. Some hope this new reality leads to long-term changes.
I think people will get used to not flying, and that's okay, maybe.
Maybe. And words about disease in Holland find their way into the lexicon of profanity.
If you stub your toe, for example, you can say anything from kanker, so that's cancer, to tering, so that's tuberculosis.
Coronavirus, way more than 4 letters and just as hurtful. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories today here on The World. Governments around the world are desperately employing strategies to halt the spread of the coronavirus: social distancing, mandatory lockdowns, and digital surveillance. 3 places to mention on that one. In Hong Kong, they're monitoring people in quarantine through electronic wristbands and a smartphone app. Russia is tapping into its existing facial recognition system to make sure people are staying home. Israel is using cell phone location data to retrace the movements of people who contracted the virus. But across Europe, surveillance like this is limited by some of the strongest data and privacy protections on Earth. Here's The World's Lydia Emanolidou.
If you live in Greece, where there's currently a nationwide lockdown, before you leave your house, you need to pick up your cell phone.
So every time I want to go somewhere, I have to send a text.
Katerina Skoudi lives in a suburb just outside of Athens. She says right now people are only allowed to go out for 6 reasons, and they have to text their reason to a number set up by the Greek government.
For example, if I want to go to the pharmacy, I have to send a text with the number 1 and my full name and address.
If she wants to go to the grocery store, it's number 2. Bank is number 3. You can also go out to help someone in need or
to work out or to take your pet out for a walk.
So you text your reason and a few seconds later.
Yes, they write you back saying metakinesi,
which means go ahead, move. If you're outside and you get caught without this confirmation, you get fined. There is a second way to get permission to go out, by filling out a paper form with the same information. Recently, Skoudi has been choosing that option because doing it digitally, she says, makes her uncomfortable.
I feel controlled, actually, with the texts, and I don't want them to have a record of me and what I did during this whole time.
Skoudi says she hasn't heard anything from the Greek government about what happens with the data millions of people are texting in. I did reach out to Greek authorities and asked if the data is being stored somewhere, for how long, and who has access to it, but I didn't hear back by airtime. Greece is not the only European country using digital tracking tools to stop the spread of the coronavirus.
We've seen different types of example of tracking coming up as a response to the COVID-19 pandemic.
Estelle Massi is with the digital advocacy group Access Now. She's based in Brussels.
We've seen how in some countries they were sharing smartphone data, smartphone location data, in order to try to ensure, for instance, that quarantines or lockdowns were respected. This was the case, for instance, in the Lombardy region of Italy.
In Poland, she says, authorities are asking people in quarantine to take selfies through an app that uses geolocation and facial recognition to prove that they're staying home. Masi says there's definitely a place for technology and data in the fight against the coronavirus, but she worries that these new forms of government surveillance will have a lasting impact on people's privacy.
It's not about not using data, it's using it responsibly.
She says that means authorities should collect only what they need, do it transparently, and get rid of all the data once this crisis is over. A big effort is now underway across Europe to basically do just that. Researchers, developers, and government officials are working to come up with a tool that will notify people who have come in contact with someone who has the coronavirus, while also maintaining their privacy. Chris Vos is one of the people involved. He's the founder of Arago, an artificial intelligence company based in Berlin. He also advises German Chancellor Angela Merkel on digital policy.
The way the outbreak was quelled in China is complete surveillance. It's proven that it works. But if we did that in any Western democracy, we would just throw democracy out the window.
What Vos and his team came up with was the source code. Think of it like the backbone of a digital system that countries can use to build their own tracking tools. The group released that code yesterday, and Germany will be the first to test it out. They're deploying an app that will warn people when they've come into contact with someone who's contracted COVID-19.
Such a solution could be data protection friendly, if the data is collected for a clearly defined purpose and both the app and the data will be deleted once the danger is over.
Ulrich Kelber is Germany's data protection commissioner. He says another key to maintaining privacy is keeping the use of the app voluntary, not forcing any Germans to use it. If they do use it, it'll be anonymous. Some people have wondered whether the fact that it's voluntary will make it less effective. Kelber says recent polls show 70 to 80% of Germans would be willing to download such an app.
In the moment you really present people the protection of their data, the IT security, and the effectiveness of the solution, there will be a high willingness amongst the population to contribute to the government's prevention efforts.
He's hoping it'll work and that it'll prove that you don't have to choose between good public health data and good privacy protections, that you can have both. For the world, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
The pandemic has prompted a global race for treatments, but when a treatment does become available, who gets access to it? This question is of growing concern to policymakers and medical officials around the globe. Dr. Manuel Martin is an advisor with Médecins Sans Frontières Access Campaign based in Geneva. He says a potential monopoly by one pharmaceutical company really worries him.
First, monopolies allow companies to set high prices which are unaffordable for the most vulnerable. And this is not only immoral, but also dangerously stupid in the context of a pandemic, because we need as many people as possible to access vaccines if we're going to defeat this thing. And that's just how herd immunity works. And the second issue with monopolies is that they increase the risk of one country hoarding all of the supply of a treatment or a vaccine, leaving very little for everybody else. And this is something we've seen before, actually, during the H1N1 pandemic of 2009, where high-income countries hogged all of the vaccine supply, crowding out low- and middle-income countries.
This pandemic with the coronavirus, it appears that there is a level of collaboration, though, for vaccine and drug research that the world has never really experienced. So, I mean, do you agree with that, first of all?
Yes, I mean, there's organizations like CEPI, which stands for the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations, which is leading the charge on a number of vaccine candidates. They have 8 vaccine candidates in their pipeline, and they were created, as a matter of fact, precisely because we didn't have vaccines to treat emerging infections. And this was one of the lessons we learned out of the 2014-2016 Ebola outbreak. We didn't have any tools to fight this epidemic. And then learning from that lesson in 2017, CEPI was created with large amounts of public and philanthropic monies to finance the research and development into these vaccines. Recently, they've been making some very encouraging steps when it comes to access and the sharing of the supply, which will come out of any CEPI-funded vaccine.
So what is the access concern then about monopoly and big pharma that might stand in the way of treatment access? It doesn't really sound like that's a big problem.
Well, we don't know that. CEPI is just one player. CEPI, as I mentioned, is funding 8 vaccine candidates, but we know that there are currently 54 in the pipeline. And we don't know what the access will look like for the others. And even for CEPI-funded vaccines, we heard that the U.S. had made a bid of worth $1 billion for a vaccine candidate that was funded by CEPI for exclusive access. And it's this kind of national control that we can't accept, and that is very dangerous. So there's work to be done by the international community to make sure that any vaccine that becomes available will be manufactured not just in one location, but in several locations across the world to match both the demand and also to dilute the risk of nationalistic takeover.
And how is that enforced?
So we would really like to see the establishment of some kind of global coordinating mechanism that would distribute the initial vaccine supply based on public health needs, obviously prioritizing healthcare workers and the most vulnerable. This could be under the auspices of the WHO, for instance, but doesn't necessarily have to be. A number of actors need to really come together and agree on a set of principles and practices to really make this happen.
Dr. Manuel Martin, an advisor with Médecins Sans Frontières Access Campaign, thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much, Marco.
Growing up, who did not have a secret language to talk to friends? Pig Latin or Ubby Dubby, anyone? In 10th century Japan, men had a hidden alphabet. Women were not allowed to learn it, so women started using their own, an alphabet called Kana Shodo. Karu Akagawa is a master of Japanese calligraphy. She says Kana Shodo is also known as women's hand.
Japanese culture mainly flourished because of women's hand. Women were now free to express themselves and assert their opinions. If you read their writings, you'll be really surprised how free they were. For example, Tale of Genji is a story that's almost about free sex. You'll be surprised that a noble woman wrote that at the end of the 10th century.
That is surprising. Are you surprised?
Yes, I think they are even more free than us in the 21st century. And that all happened because of this women's hand script.
So we've put photos of these Kana Shodo characters on our Instagram for listeners to see. We are at PRI of the World. Karu, describe what Kana Shodo looks like for the untrained eye. Does it look significantly different than the men's alphabet?
Kana Shodo has a more sexy appearance because women were not really allowed to show their faces to men, and they never appeared in front of men. So the only way to express their taste was through their letters or handwritings. So they paid attention that they use really fluid, sexy lines.
So Kana Shodo had a number of uses and was widely used for, like 1,000 years? What caused it to practically vanish?
First of all, because in Kana scripts, we have more than one character for each sound. So in 1900, the government said this is getting too difficult to teach in Japanese elementary school. So they chose one character for each sound. And the second reason is because the Kana characters are written interconnected with each other.
Like cursive.
Yes, it was not really suitable for a modern printing system.
You're one of the only few people who can still read and write using Kana Shodo. Is there a future for it today? Like, how are you sharing this with younger generations?
The problem is the Kana Shodo population is a really aging population. So I am really concerned that in maybe 10, 20 years, the population is really plummeting, maybe. I also try to reach out to foreigners because I think in 21st century, not only Japanese, but also foreigners could keep this tradition going.
Karu Akagawa is a master of Japanese calligraphy, speaking with us from her home in London. Thank you very much. Good luck with this, keeping it alive.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Compared to its neighbors, Sweden's approach to the coronavirus is a real outlier. We'll look at why just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. No lockdown, no quarantines, just common sense and a big dose of hope. That's the prescription to combat the spread of the coronavirus in Sweden. The Swedish government has left it up to individuals to decide whether to stay home or venture out. Schools and restaurants remain open, but as the number of cases and deaths continue to rise in Sweden, its strategy is getting some backlash. Epidemiologist Johan Giesecke is an advisor to the World Health Organization and a senior professor at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm. So what are the building blocks of Sweden's approach to the coronavirus?
One, stay at home as soon as you feel the slightest sign of infection. Everyone should stay at home if they feel even a little sick. We have no visits to homes for the aged to protect the old and the frail from getting infected. They should stay at home if you're over 70 or if you have any chronic disease. Secondary schools and universities are closed, but the schools from, the kindergartens and schools up to age 15 are open. we say that there should be max 50 people in an event, and that might even be police.
So this seems like a somewhat laissez-faire approach. What is the idea behind it, Doctor?
To achieve the aims of the strategy, not by laws or policing, but rather by explaining the rationale for restrictions to people. And people are not stupid. You don't have to force them to do things. They understand, and they do what you want them to do anyway.
I mean, Sweden's current state epidemiologist says the country's strategy was rooted in a long tradition of respecting free will. But does that actually work in Sweden?
Yes. If you come to Stockholm now, you won't see many people on the street. They stay at home because the authorities have told them that's a good thing to do. The restaurants are closing because they don't have customers. The pubs are closed, not by any ordinance, by lack of customers, because people are staying at home.
More than 2,000 doctors and scientists and professors signed a petition last week. You probably know this, calling on the government to...
They were not scientists. And it's a very strange list of names. I don't know where they got it.
You say there were no scientists in there, but there was a chairman of the Nobel Foundation. One immunology researcher said they are leading us to catastrophe. She's at your institute. So you disagree with all these people?
Yes.
And what research, what science are you looking at that suggests your protocol is better than what they suggest?
Well, the basic problem is that there's no science behind any restriction to take. Closing your borders, that's never been proven to have any effect. Closing schools, that's never been proven to have any effect. Washing hands, that's good. We've known that for 150 years, actually, that washing hands is good. But most of these actions that are taken have very frail scientific foundation.
That's not what we're hearing from the WHO, which has been urging countries to close their borders and stop travel.
Yes, but there's no science behind it.
And what is the science behind your protocol?
Well, if you don't have any science behind actions that may hurt economy and social life, why take them? That's one reason, and that is that politicians want to show action, strength, decisiveness. It's a political thing.
If you saw numbers starting to spike in Sweden, would you say that the approach that Sweden is currently taking is the proper one?
No, but there are more steps to take. And the Swedish CDC, the Agency for Public Health, has sort of made a staircase of steps. So you introduce one step and then you see what happens, and then you introduce another step and see what happens. There are more tools left in the toolbox.
But you have not employed them yet?
Not yet.
Epidemiologist Johan Jessica, an advisor to the World Health Organization and a senior professor at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
The global pandemic that is taking so many lives may be a questionable backdrop to talk about swearing, but there is a link. In the Dutch language, many profanities and expletives are derived from disease. In the Netherlands, you might tell someone you really dislike to optiefen or typhus off. It's a contrast to English, where many swear words and phrases are linked to sex. Think of typhus off and do your own substitution. Martin Vandermeulen is here to explain how disease vocabulary found its way into Dutch curses. Martin is a Dutch linguist and the co-author of a book translated roughly as The Big Dutch Book of Swearing. So you are the man, Martin. Give us some other examples of Dutch profanities or expletives that are rooted in disease.
If you stub your toe, for example, you can say anything from kanker, so that's cancer, to tering, so that's tuberculosis, I think. And we even see a little bit of corona coming in nowadays.
In what context have you already heard the Dutch word for corona or coronavirus? Like, how would someone use it?
So there's a construction in Dutch, which is krijg de, and then the disease. So that's roughly translated as, I hope you get this or that disease. And I've seen it on Twitter, that eternal cesspool. People use it.
So how did this happen? What's the history?
So there are a few hypotheses about this. The baseline is that we don't really know, because we have very few sources dating back to the 15th, 16th century where people actually use swear words. But what we think at the moment is that it's related to the rise of Calvinism, a type of Protestantism, where the focus of people's life shifted from living for the afterlife to living for the life now. And that, of course, led to diminishing strength of goddamn, because of course the damnation is for the afterlife, and they turn to disease.
How common, though, are these disease curse phrases today in the Netherlands?
So especially in the western parts of the Netherlands, so that's the urbanized Amsterdam, The Hague, Rotterdam mostly, there it's relatively widespread, especially among younger males. Outside of these areas, it seems to be less in use. Although it's used in Dutch, it's definitely an element that's only used in the Netherlands. So in Belgium, in Flanders, where Dutch is also spoken, this is unheard of to use any disease curse word.
The English language used to have words or expressions linked to disease. There's Shakespeare's "a pox on both your houses," but no one would say that today. When did the English language, I know you're a Dutch linguist, but do you know when the English language shifted its swear words from disease themes to sex and religion?
I'm not very well versed in my Shakespearean curse words, but what I would say is that it's not just Dutch that has expressions using diseases. There are other languages that also have these disease expressions, for example, Thai and Korean and Polish and Danish. But the difference is the sheer amount. So in Dutch, we have such a rich cursing vocabulary as opposed to these other languages. And I think it may have been the case that this, especially with plague, this may have been one of those words that was used more widely next to other words.
What is your favorite Dutch expletive?
Actually, plant names in Dutch are very useful for this. So what you want from a curse is a few plosive sounds, right? So P, T, and K. And there's a kind of tulip. Very fitting, of course, for Dutch, which is pronounced as bos tulip.
Can you help us understand what it means literally?
Bos is forest and tulp is tulip.
And how would you use it in a sentence?
You can say that someone's an a-hole or an idiot, for example. So you're such a bos tulip. Although, as far as I'm aware, I'm the only one using it so far.
I might just start using plant swear words like you're such a ficus.
It works.
It's got some plosives in there. Maarten van der Meulen is a Dutch linguist and the co-author of a book translated roughly as the Big Dutch Book of Swearing. Maarten, thank you very much.
My absolute pleasure.
News headlines are around the corner. You're listening to The World. Online dating in the time of coronavirus, things are just getting weird.
Like 90% of the guys have started to make COVID-19 jokes or say that you should date them because they have a stash of toilet paper and hand sanitizer.
Swipe left. New metrics for what makes somebody attractive online. That's coming up here on The World. Sailors are especially vulnerable in this outbreak. They live in cramped quarters on what some have called large floating petri dishes. A U.S. aircraft carrier is currently docked off Guam, the U.S. island territory in the Pacific. More than 100 sailors on board have tested positive for the coronavirus, so thousands of crew members have disembarked. When it comes to sailor safety and their readiness to defend the U.S. on the high seas, the buck stops with acting U.S. Navy Secretary Thomas Modley. He joins us now from the Pentagon. Thanks very much for taking the time today, Secretary Modley. What is the latest on your sailors on the USS Theodore Roosevelt in Guam? How are they doing?
Yeah, we're going through a pretty methodical process out there to rotate sailors off the ship. We're reacting on the fly in a lot of ways to the circumstances on the ground as this virus continues to spread. And I think, you know, no one was naive enough to think that it wouldn't go onto a ship, and so no one's panicking. It's going well. The challenge we have is that ship is not a cruise ship. It is a warship, and it has two nuclear power plants on it, and it's got a lot of weapons and aircraft, and so you can't just evacuate everybody. You have to maintain a certain level of people that can work the ship, maintain the security of the ship, and that's about 1,000 people, maybe, you know, between 800 and 1,000 people that we have to make sure are clean and can continue to work on the ship.
Obviously, an aircraft carrier, nuclear-powered, makes a huge difference. Is there a playbook for this kind of situation, or have you been creating one as you go along?
I think everyone is sort of reacting on the fly to this pandemic. I will say, if I can emphasize a point, I think we have up to about 111 people on the ship who have tested positive right now, and we've tested over 1,000 people. So, you know, it's about a 10% hit rate there. But I also would say none of those sailors are hospitalized or have had to have been hospitalized. They've got mild to medium symptoms of like the flu. Some of them have no symptoms at all.
As for planning for a pandemic, the military did have intelligence on this. So when did the planning really start to address potential scenarios like what you're now facing with the USS Roosevelt?
Oh, it started immediately. We started talking about this, you know, way back in January in terms of how we would react and getting guidance out to the ships. This is the only deployed ship we have that has any cases on it. And at any one given time, we have 90 or so of these ships out there at sea. And this is the only ship that we have that's deployed that has this situation on it right now. We've had some other cases in the single digits on some ships that are in port. We've been quickly able to isolate those people and keep the virus from spreading rapidly. But no, we've been planning for this and thinking about this and looking at contingencies and asking our teams to be creative, not just in how they prevent the spread on the ships, but how the Navy and Marine Corps team can come to the aid of the nation in this process. And we've sent two big hospital ships to Los Angeles and New York to help out with that. The process of getting them ready was accelerated by months to get them ready. We had well over 200 volunteers from our Reserve Corps volunteer to go into the fight with us on this.
Surely you can't be counting on the Roosevelt being the only vessel that will be impacted by the coronavirus.
We think there will be others that will be impacted by this. I think that's just a natural thing. But we're not allowing any of the ships to go into port and we're allowing them to go into port only for supplies, but no one's allowed to go and do Liberty or anything like that. So we've really tightened that down.
Secretary Moodley, the goals you're pursuing sometimes clash. Protecting U.S. sailors from harm can mean reducing combat effectiveness. Do those contradictory goals present you with a dilemma right now?
Look, that's always our primary objective, is to maintain the safety and health of our sailors and Marines and their families, of course. We always focus on that. But we also have a mission to defend the nation. And so you look at, we have doctors that we have now sent, and doctors and medical corpsmen that we sent into two of the biggest hotspots in the country, New York and Los Angeles. You know, that's what the nation expects their armed forces to do, to come to the assistance of the nation when it needs it, and that's what we're doing.
How much is the U.S. Navy deployed to domestic hospitals right now and setting up field hospitals?
We have the two ships. We have one in Los Angeles, and we have one in New York that just arrived a couple days ago. Each one of those ships has about 1,100 people on each one of them. We've also deployed something called the Expeditionary Medical Teams and sent one to assist on the ground at the convention centers in Dallas and in New Orleans. So they're on the ground right now. We're looking at other areas where we have a couple more of these teams that are being assembled now that we can do the same thing in other cities. In all likelihood, they'll go to New York to assist in the situation there. And that's just the Navy. The Army is heavily engaged in New York City right now, helping to set up the Javits Center as a place to take on patients and other potential areas with hotels to have areas for patients to be taken care of.
Acting U.S. Navy Secretary Thomas Moodley speaking with us from the Pentagon. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
If it's not obvious, the pandemic has impacted nearly every aspect of our lives, even the climate. That's the focus today of our weekly segment we call The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
Changes in global transportation have resulted in a massive decrease in carbon emissions that drive climate change. Less commuting, less leisure travel, less shipping. All of that means less greenhouse gases coming from tailpipes and jet engines. Some are hoping that this disruption will trigger longer-lasting lifestyle changes. The world's Anna Kusmer reports.
You might have heard of the flight-shaming movement, or Flygskam, in Sweden, where it started. Here's one you might not have heard of.
It's smygflyga, sneak flying, when you fly somewhere and go on holiday, but you don't tell anyone.
Swedish singer-songwriter Stefan Lindberg is a proponent of the movement to fly less to cut carbon emissions. By last year, it had helped trigger a 9% drop in Swedish domestic flights. Air travel is down way more than that now. Airlines have cut up to 95% of their trips due to the pandemic. That means significantly lower greenhouse gas emissions. And Lindberry hopes it won't be a temporary change.
I think people will get used to not flying, and that's okay. I think this is a rehearsal, actually.
A rehearsal for living more sustainably. Even though social distancing rules aren't permanent, our reluctance to fly may outlast the pandemic. After 9/11, it took 3 years for flying to return to normal levels. And aviation isn't the only transportation sector being upended by the pandemic. It's also affecting international shipping, which is down 70% in some parts of the world. Amy Myers Jaffe is an expert on energy and climate at the Council of Foreign Relations. She says the steep drop in manufacturing and trade from the virus has messed up complex supply chains.
For example, car industries in South Korea and Japan were affected by the Chinese manufacturing slowdown because there were component parts that were needed and the Chinese factories had to close.
Jaffe argues the pandemic will be a wake-up call for countries who will be encouraged to bring some manufacturing and agriculture closer to home.
This experience is going to show people that maybe it's not desirable to be buying foods from all around the world and shipping foods all around the world. Countries are going to feel worried.
Even before coronavirus, shipping had taken a hit because of tensions over tariffs and the U.S.-China trade war. Jaffe wonders whether the pandemic will be like putting oil on the fire. The pandemic has also drastically cut down on day-to-day travel as more of us are working from home. That plays into another growing trend of more remote work, says Prithviraj Chaudhuri at the Harvard Business School.
It could sort of like be that big catalyst that needed the economy to push itself towards remote work. This could be the real tectonic shift.
A 2018 global report found more than half of companies surveyed allowed some degree of remote work, up from previous years. Now, with the pandemic, just about every company that can has figured out how to make work from home work.
Since it's playing out across almost every country, it'll be much more global and people will see the benefits in a multitude of ways.
Across sectors, across the world, carbon emissions are down, 25% at the virus's peak in China, and big European polluters could see a similar drop. The pandemic may help some countries hit emissions targets under the Paris Agreement that seemed out of reach pre-COVID-19. The changes will mostly be short-lived, but like Chaudhuri, Gillian Annable from the University of Leeds says some behaviors might stick.
What this shows is that we can adapt, that there is a lot of travel that we do that is discretionary, and that we can pull it back.
We're shopping less frequently and generally sticking close to home, all things that would help us cut carbon emissions if they became long-term habits.
We need people to shop locally. We need people to do much more leisure locally. We need people to do online shopping and online working from home where they can.
Annable hopes that the virus will change what's considered normal when it comes to how we move around. Back in Sweden, musician Staffan Lindberg has also been thinking about the new normal.
I have one song. It's in Swedish. I'm so sorry. Per vi utväxthusgas med flygandet till vita stränder på jorden tar vi tabernas.
The song is about how quickly the extraordinary becomes ordinary.
Och farsan är en gammal man och Donald Trump har blivit diktator.
If the pandemic has taught us anything, it's that what's normal can change dramatically and quickly for public health and maybe for the climate, too. For the world, I'm Anna Kussmer.
När det var nytt var det katastrofalt. Men bara tiden får gå och de som styr håller på blir det mänskligt och jävligt normalt. Tja, tja, tja.
If you're at home, you should be safe. But what if home itself is not safe to begin with? In this time of social isolation, France is funding hotel rooms for survivors of domestic violence. It is a scary time for victims of domestic abuse. In China, domestic violence cases tripled during the lockdown there. Europe is also now seeing a surge of cases. Laura Albu is vice president of the European Women's Lobby, a network of women's associations across the EU.
Women going for medicine can ask for the MASK 19, which is a code for the pharmacist who know that the woman is in danger. She cannot talk because she is accompanied by the abuser usually, so they can call the emergency 112 for them. Hmm.
So the woman, the victim in this case, would go to the pharmacy and tell the pharmacist, I want MASK 19, and they would know what that means. They would know that they're at home with an abuser.
We know that the abuser is not only controlling their life, their daily life in a normal way, but also their phones, their computers. We try to see right now how to reach them through the messages in tampon boxes or detergent boxes, this kind of information, because we know usually men are not willing to wash the clothes or do anything, laundry in the house.
I mean, these sound like innovative and smart solutions, but I would think ultimately women and girls would most benefit from strong government policies and reforms. You focus on Europe. What type of legislation would you like to see in place that would address the dilemma of women and girls who might find themselves in isolation with an abuser?
When we have only men around the table discussing women issues and how is COVID affecting women, and that's a topic discussed by men, and we see that also on the news, and we have seen also on the television shows, and all the times the experts who are there are men discussing women problems. So it's funny, but so you see that women are holding and supporting the society right now. And so, but they are not the one in charge of allocation of resources, and they are not in charge of coordination of emergency services.
Right. The World Health Organization says that women make up 70% of health and care taking roles. So do you think women and girls are disproportionately affected by COVID-19?
I can't say it's a good moment. It's just an awakening moment for the society, because during the people say they want to go back to normal. But what was normal before for the women, it was something which was not seen in terms of inequalities. And it's just right now much more obvious how much women are taking care of our economy and how much women are taking care of the entire society. So actually, I think the disproportionate burden on women need to be tackled. Maybe other crises in the future could be better coordinated if women are also in the teams who are working on that.
Laura Albu is vice president of the European Women's Lobby, a network of women's associations across the European Union. She's been speaking with us from Romania. Thank you very much, Laura.
Thank you.
The rapid spread of the coronavirus is closing borders around the globe. So when the U.S. and Canada agreed to shut down their 5,000-plus-mile border to non-essential traffic, it put the small community of Hyder, Alaska, in a pinch. Around 80 residents there rely on neighboring Stewart across the border in British Columbia for their gas and groceries. They are two towns split by an international border. Still, they're very friendly.
In times like this especially, we are reminded that while we are technically two countries and two communities, we really are one community.
That's the mayor of Stewart, Gina McKay, on Twitter last week, pledging to support her neighbors in Hyder, Alaska. The non-essential travel rule has made it tough for some people to get across the border for work, and has put a stop to people who like to take their snowmobiles out and ride on the other side of the frontier. McKay told the CBC that border security is still allowing Hyder residents to make trips to Stewart, but asked residents to try to limit them now.
Get everything together, come over once a week, get everything and go straight back home. And it so far is working out quite well.
For McKay and the residents of Stewart, if things get worse and the border between the two small towns is completely shut down, they will still be there for their American friends.
I've lived in Stewart my whole life, and I have known the people in Hyder for a very, very long time. Nobody's getting stuck like that. We will help, and we will do whatever we can to get them through this.
That's Gina McKay, mayor of Stewart, British Columbia, on helping her U.S. neighbors to the south. It feels like just about everything has come to a complete halt. But what about dating and relationships? Tough times for love and romance too, I guess. Dating apps are warning people not to meet face-to-face. Weddings are being canceled or postponed. And divorce rates, in some parts of the world at least, are said to be on the rise. From London, the world's Orla Barry reports on love in the time of coronavirus.
A first date with a complete stranger while in social isolation might seem less than ideal. But the dating apps say that's exactly what's going on right now. A little loneliness, perhaps, could be a factor.
I feel like they're just bored.
Sajban Sachdev lives in Montreal. She's on the dating app Hinge and says her popularity has soared.
Now all the boys are like giving so much attention and I'll have like 24 messages when I wake up in the morning. And normally these are people who would have ghosted me like 4 weeks ago.
Sachdev says those potential suitors are talking themselves up in specific ways.
Like 90% of the guys have started to make COVID-19 jokes or say that you should date them because they have a stash of toilet paper and hand sanitizer.
But joking about the pandemic might not be the best way to spark a new relationship. Sachdev started talking to one guy, Sergey, a kickboxer, a few weeks ago. She says things started off really promising. Until one day, he mentioned he wasn't feeling very well.
He was like, oh yeah, I was having headaches and I wasn't sure if it's from the coronavirus or it's from a concussion. And I was like, excuse me, what? And he was like, well, yeah, because I was in China.
Sachdev says she wasn't actually sure if Sergey was joking around or not. But when he stopped messaging, she didn't pursue it. Most dating apps are telling users not to meet up. This goes against the advice that dating coach Catherine Baldwin gives her clients during normal times. But now she agrees that it's just too risky. Baldwin says people also need to put limits on their online chats.
Just like if we were going for a coffee date, we'd want to keep that coffee date to an hour and a half so that we don't build a relationship that's not based on reality because we've only just met.
But singles are trying to be inventive. Lots of dates are happening on FaceTime or Skype, over dinner and maybe a bottle of wine. Some people are meeting up to watch Netflix together, just in separate apartments. And then there are those like Helen Bechtold in Spain, who took things to the opposite extreme.
After knowing someone for 2 dates, we just went for it.
Bechtold, who's from Indiana, was travelling through Asia when the coronavirus outbreak hit. She moved to Madrid, thinking she'd be safer in Europe. During a quick trip to Malaga, she met an Italian man on the dating app Bumble. But the morning after their second date, Bechtold says she got an alarming text.
And then when I woke up Thursday morning was when I got a notification from my friend in Madrid that said, you either need to get to Madrid now or it's unlikely that you'll be able to get here. And I was like, well, I should go to Madrid. And this guy, Mr. X, was like, what do you mean you're going to go to Madrid? Like, it's literally the next epicenter. Are you sure you want to go?
Mr. X, as Bechtold calls him, invited her to move in with him that same day. Then Malaga went into lockdown.
Yeah, 19 days in almost 3 weeks where we have been living together. And we knew each other for a week before, so almost our 1 month anniversary.
And in spite of everything, she says they're enjoying their very unexpected relationship.
The world feels like it's contracting and we get to expand what it means to really care for another human being.
Bechtold says she's not sure what happens with her and Mr. X after the lockdown ends. Katie Bock, an academic in Arizona, thought she knew exactly where her relationship was headed.
April 25th, 2020.
Bock's wedding date, the day she would tie the knot with her fiancé Scott Davis. At least that was the plan. Here's Davis.
Yeah, I had family right off the bat that let me know that they wouldn't be attending, which, you know, I get, I totally understand. And so we were starting to get the notion that a lot more people weren't going to show up.
By mid-March, Bock says she realised that they couldn't go ahead with their big day.
I had somewhat of a breakdown. I talked to my older sister about it because it was sad. A few days later, I decided, you know what, it would just not be a happy time with all that's going on. And a lot of people couldn't come. So we cancelled probably a few weeks ago.
The wedding date is now next November and the honeymoon to Costa Rica will be in December. Lauren Holden and Gary Cripps from Lancaster in the UK took a different gamble.
We were just keeping an eye on the news, really, and obviously it was getting more and more sort of hairy as the days went on. So on the Sunday, my boyfriend turned around and said, do you think we should bring it forward?
Holden and Cripps rearranged everything in 48 hours. They sorted out paperwork, called the caterers and notified their guests before the town went into lockdown. Their smaller than originally planned wedding was the last one held in Lancaster Town Hall in March.
It was parents, sisters and brothers, bridesmaids, a couple of aunties, and that was it really. A lot of people were feeling quite devastated for us ringing us up and we're really sorry you've had to do this, but we just thought, blimmin' heck, we've been really fortunate there.
Holden says the couple has been in near total isolation ever since.
It's actually been quite nice, really, as daft as it sounds, being social distancing and just being us two. Yeah, I thought we'd be tearing each other's hair out by now, but it's been all right.
It's not happily ever after, but a honeymoon at home in quarantine will have to do. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
Sending you big love from the world. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. You stay safe out there. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.